Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Brussel in Carmel, California, broadcast number 491, and is May the 3rd, 1981. Before I get into the bulk of the material this evening, I wanted to tell some of you researchers who subscribe to the tapes or new listeners that the magazine, it's an independent little journal printed by Mr. Edmund Berkeley in New England and Massachusetts, Newtonville, Massachusetts, is back in the publishing business again. He started a series of magazines. His magazine is called People and the Pursuit of Truth. And Edmund Berkeley was always a computer specialist writing a trade magazine for computer people. And years ago, he got on to the conspiracy that killed John Kennedy and then Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King and Watergate. And he had a wonderful newsletter that stopped for about a year and a half, and he's publishing again. And if you want the address, you can write to me or call, or if you can remember it, it's Berkeley, like Berkeley University, the city Berkeley, Berkeley Enterprises, 815 Washington Street, Newtonville, Massachusetts, 02160. This is the beginning of his newsletter again, and the first issue has information about Robert Blakey and how he covered up the investigation of the assassination of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. The second time it was to be investigated by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, Robert Blakey was brought in and still covered up the conspiracy and the CIA involvement. And it's a very interesting newsletter. The man has a lot of integrity. He takes articles from the various researchers around the country, and it's worthwhile to subscribe to if you've never heard of it. And for those of you who have, you can start taking it again. They're back into business again. I do want to mention a local matter, which I don't usually do on this program because the tapes go far away and it doesn't concern people out of the city, but I don't want local people to lose sight of the fact that the trial of Russell Little of the SLA, the famous SLA, is taking place in Salinas right now at the Superior Court. He was charged for killing Dr. Marcus Foster along with his buddy, Mr. Romero. And the trial, the first time he was convicted of killing the superintendent of the schools up in Oakland, one man was shot with cyanide bullets. That was Dr. Foster. He was a black man, the superintendent of schools. And his friend, Mr. Blackburn, was shot by a different type of bullet. And his friend lived. The white man lived and the black man died. They had the mixed bullets. And it's an interesting trial. I wrote a long time ago, 7 years ago, the SLA is the CIA. And I'm going to do maybe one whole evening on this and update you on the trial. But I think if you live in the local area and you can get off, go call the Superior Court at 8 in the morning or later and see if there's a morning session. If there is, it starts at 9 in the morning or the afternoons are at 1 o'clock every day. But Friday, I'll be out there tomorrow, and I was out last week and the week before, and I'm going to try to take in as many days as I can. The trial of Joseph Romero and Russell Little is important because just as I read on the air last week, the article from the Washington Post on the declaration of war that came out of Washington, D.C., by a far right, farther right than the Nazis, if there is such a thing, at least the group that are organized right now, a fanatic, religious fanatic, who's going to begin a series of assassinations and has teams throughout the country to do assassinations. I had written that the first declaration of war against the people in the United States was right here in the Bay Area when the SLA was formed, and went into a chronology of events that led to the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. But Russell Little was just one member that was recruited in Florida from a conservative white family who came out to California, went right into the prisons with Donald DeFries and into Vacaville, along with Emily and William Harris, who came out from Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana, and so forth. The trial is fantastic for the things they don't cover and for the laid-back, easy way it goes. Dr. Marcus Foster's name isn't even hardly mentioned, and there's an interplay of personalities that's very interesting. Russell Little's mother came out here from Florida last week, the week before, to watch for about 3 weeks of the trial, and she was complaining on how terrible it was that her son, who was such a fine Christian, brought up in such a nice home, came out to the Bay Area and got mixed up with all those terrible hippies and those people with tambourines. And I couldn't resist saying to her that tambourines don't kill people. Maybe a little cruel, but that's the fact of life. And then you go back in the courtroom and hear about the possessions in his home of the cyanide bullets and the hollowed bullets and the mechanisms of hollowing them out and putting the cyanide in, and the crummy activities that these people were into, and the displacement of them coming to Florida to rearrange prisoners' lives in California, or the United Farm Workers and the Venceremos and the United Prisoners Union. These people came from the East, a lot of them from Philadelphia, Florida, and Indiana, as part of the Operation Chaos and COINTEL program to break up the radical movements in the Bay Area, and were very useful in doing just that. An important part of that chronology of these people was that several days or weeks before Dr. Marcus Foster was shot, the American Nazi Party was handing out notices at a shopping center in San Leandro that Dr. Marcus Foster would be murdered. They said this was going to take place, and they had pamphlets. And on the pamphlets they handed out, they said there might be shotgun blasts into the guts of mixed master principals and superintendents, meaning one black and one white. And this was the American Nazi Party. And right after that, that was October 1973. And November 6, 1973, Dr. Foster, who was black, did have the cyanide bullets, and Robert Blackburn, who was white, had regular bullets and survived. But were these fellows individuals who were independent Nazis, such as John Hinckley, who shot at Ronald Reagan, and will go into the shootout in Washington in a few minutes and continue on that story? No, because they were allowed into the prisons. They worked with Colston Westbrook of the CIA. They worked with Donald DeFries from the Los Angeles Police Department. And organizing in 1971 down in San Diego was Donald Segretti, who was paid by Clement Stone. I mentioned him before as very much part of the Hinckley operation, the Reagan cover-up, and into the middle of the Texas Chicago combine of a fascism and a combination of the Turning the World Christian and fascist organizations. Donald DeGretti worked through people like Clement Stone. He worked with the Minutemen in California, with the Secret Army Organization in San Diego. Segretti funded the secret intelligence money. He met with the paramilitary right-wing groups. This was the Segretti that worked for Dwight Chapin and Richard Nixon at the time of Watergate, when Nixon was caught at Watergate. And at the time, they were planning to kidnap radicals at the Republican convention and send them out of the country. The Minutemen, the Los Angeles Police Department, the Squad 19, the White House, through Dwight Chapin, the appointment secretary, and E. Howard Hunt, and James McCord, and these people worked with the Minutemen. They worked with the FBI. They worked with the secret army organizations and with the Nazi Party. So when pamphlets are handed out in October of 73 that Dr. Marcus Foster will be assassinated, and when he, in fact, is assassinated November 6, 1973, and then January the 10th, 1974, Joseph Romero and Russell Little were arrested and charged with the murder of Dr. Foster. But they weren't just independent. That's a point I want to make, any more than John Hinckley. The background of Little is important, where he came from, where Colston Westbrook came from, where Angela and Gary Atwood and Willie Wolfe, the whole can of worms, were well-trained agents with a lot of security to carry out the kidnapping of Patty Hearst and to infiltrate all the organizations, the American Indian Movement and all the labor movements that were working in the Berkeley, San Francisco area and as far down as the Monterey Peninsula. I got out a letter to take to the trial tomorrow for Mrs. Little. She's a very nice, kind of confused, innocent woman who doesn't understand what culture produces, the kind of kid that's been in jail 7 years so far and is on trial again for this murder. I have a letter that Russell Little wrote at the time that I wrote my article for the Berkeley Barb on the SLA. This was an article saying, is Donald DeFries the first black Lee Harvey Oswald? And it came out 2 weeks before the six of them were killed by the SWAT team in Los Angeles, which I also anticipated and went into the organization of the SLA. I hope this is okay to read some of this on the air. I won't read it all, but he wrote to KPFA and complained about this article in the Barb and wrote to Mark Schwartz. He said, "Mark, I'm extremely angry, very angry, and read this with feeling. I just read the Barb April 25th issue by Mae Brussel. That dizzy bitch can kiss my ass. Before I get off on her BS, I've got a question for you. She quotes letters out of Death Row. Who is sending these? How does she get a hold of them? That pompous bitch has the nerve to call Jonathan Jackson a patsy." Jonathan Jackson was the young person who was shot at the Marin County shootout when the Judge Haley was murdered, and that was set up by the LAPD and the same criminal conspiracy section that had hired DeFreeze later for the SLA job. He said, "I hope she drops dead tomorrow." And he says, "I question her trying to put the SLA into the pig conspiracy." And he wrote a four-letter word on repression and resistance. And, it's a nasty letter. How does she dare say that we are part of any kind of operation? But the format of the letter looks like a textbook where he was taught this kind of rhetoric, similar to the kind of teachings maybe that John Hinckley got in his courses on Nazism in Lubbock, Texas, at the university where he'd memorize Mein Kampf and study labor organizations and concentration camps. Well, I do want to go into the shootout at the Old Corral. I think that is terribly important, the Corral being the Hilton Hotel in Washington, D.C. And the more silent the news media is, the angrier I get about it. But one more item or a couple of items before we get to that is that among all the bad news and the power struggle of Alexander Haig and the talk of World War III, there are journalists and newspapers and people now moving, catching on to Haig and Weinberger and Walter Stesel and Mr. Allen and Mr. Casey and that clique around Richard Nixon and the rhetoric of Nixon getting the Russians for the first 30 days in the administration and then after that just pounding away. But there are some articles, and I don't mean single columns or letters to the editor, but what I noticed last week is that there were three almost entire half-page articles. And I'll read you the titles, and one, a full-page ad for the New York Times, which I think is beginning to show the sentiments of some people. One was April 26th for the New York Times, and the large headline type was, "Some Mavericks Question the Relevance of Armed Forces Strategy and Hardware. Is a gung-ho the way to go?" And finally, this was a half page that some are questioning the relevance of the things that the Pentagon wants. Another article from the Los Angeles Times, a full half page on the 29th of April, "Foreign policy should consist of more than anti-Sovietism." That this is all we're getting. And very interesting distinctions of some serious problems. Very good articles, a half page. Another one, again from the New York Times, entire half page, April 26th. "There may be more to foreign policy than stopping the Soviets." It sounds like the other one above, but one's the New York Times and one's the Los Angeles Times, one written by James Chase, another by Bernard Gwertzman. And then this article is titled also "Disputing the Vicar." Alexander Haig calls himself the Vicar of the United States. His brother is a priest at Loyola in Washington, D.C., and he's on the board of directors there, a Catholic priest, but he refers to himself as the Vicar of the United States. And then, finally, a full-page ad in the New York Times, and if you have your pencil, write this address down, because you should be used to having a pencil if you listen to me on the air. If not, you can call or write me a letter and get it. It's a full-page ad in the New York Times, Sunday, April 26, written by William Myers and Joseph Schwartz, called "Coalition for a Decent USA." The address, you can send a contribution, and I'll tell you what it is about, 420 Lexington Avenue, room 2060, New York, New York, 10017. And there's a cartoon, a large cartoon of Caspar Weinberger, Secretary of Defense, and Ronald Reagan, and George Bush, and Alexander Haig, and they're playing with war toys, and they're winding them up. And then on the floor, they have their toys moving about. But the thing that impressed me about the full-page ad was a list of questions, and it appealed to me because my objection to many of the movements that are going today are that today there was a demonstration against El Salvador. Tomorrow it'll be Save the Whales. The next day it's against the nuclear plant down in San Luis Obispo or Rhode Island or you name it. Another time against the nuclear weapons up at Lawrence Livermore Lab. And people are not capable of confronting the entire fabric of the problems as a total problem and face what the problems are and the people behind them. I talk every week on this program about the people behind the problems and how they cause the problems. But this ad for a coalition for a decent USA, I'll read you some of the things they say, but the final sentence they ask is, can a president who is basically a decent man pursue policies that are not? And they make several points. They brought out the inflation that is going to eat away your pocketbook and your life savings, the billions that are put on armaments, that the most inflationary kind of purchasing is spending on weapons where no consumer goods or services are used. They ask, how do you stop inflation to spend billions on the military, and how do you help by cutting social programs? How is that anti-inflationary? Where does it help? Are nuclear wars fightable? Are they winnable? You know, for the Pentagon to say we'll settle for 20 million dead, who is to decide which ones are the 20 millions, and is that a victory? Is it winnable at all? Do our leaders toy with our lives and not their own when they talk of winning a nuclear war by letting 20 million die? Are we more secure today after decades of producing nuclear weapons? The argument for having them was that they make us secure. Are we more secure now that we have them and we've dropped it? Well, South Africa has it, and if Libya has one, and Syria and Pakistan and India and Argentina and Brazil, and you go on and on, are you going to be secure because they have them? They said, would we be more secure if we straightened our economy and strengthened it and got it going instead? Would it be more decent to use armament billions to fight hunger and poverty, in the world? And this is the contradiction I spent so much time with on the air last week, talking about S, the Werner Erhard Program, or World Vision, or these great food programs that bring in a few grains to people and leave and promise them a happy road to the next life, you know, an easier passage through death and starvation without giving them the means of controlling their own life and their production and taking the things from their earth, the minerals and earth, back for their own houses and schools instead of flying in like great angels and dropping some seeds into their hungry mouth. And the more devout, the more religious the church group, the more they support the radical right that wants the weapons and the armaments that keep these countries impoverished. We sell them any kind of piece of junk or hardware, whether we need it or not, and sell them the Bibles and the church with it and the missionaries that turn them Christian before they die. And they ask the question, these people, a coalition for a decent USA, is it more decent to use armament billions for fighting hunger and poverty? Then they said, should we challenge the Soviet Union to join in a campaign of escalation of weapons, or do we want to match weapon for weapon? Does this make sense? Does our government care that small business will be going bankrupt because of record high interest and mortgage rates? We can't buy a house. You can't rent an apartment. Our savings are jeopardized by the losses suffered in the savings institutions. More businesses are going under. Will the oil companies and use their profits to buy up our businesses as they go under? This is what Chase Manhattan, Rockefeller, and various banks did during the Depression. When the farmers migrated and moved and left those farms, they bought up those farms. And the businesses that thrive, this coalition says, are the oil companies and the military hardware, and do they control these prices to buy up our bankrupt businesses? Is there a serious threat to the environment having people like James G. Watt for Interior Secretary and Ann Gorsuch as Administrator of the Environmental Agency? Will the cuts in welfare be counterproductive? Will the working poor have no incentive and put them back on full-time welfare? Should our government be abandoning cities, education, housing, health, transportation, the minorities, and tell us to fend for themselves? Now, I'm reading all of this to you because it hits many of the basic things that I see happening by the systematic assassination of particular people who would not allow these things to escalate. We have permitted butchers to get into office who have no regard for your oil prices, your energy, your utilities, your savings, your bank accounts, your health, your housing, your education, your clean air, your transportation. They're taking away the Amtrak, the funds for the Amtrak, they raise the price of the airplane ticket. We'll be cut off from each other by taking the means of getting to each other away from us. And what is accomplished? And they ask the question at the end, can a president who is basically a decent man pursue this kind of a escalation? Now, you have to go under the assumption that maybe Ronald Reagan is basically a decent man, but maybe we have to do a little bit more homework into where Ronald Reagan came from. In the meantime, you can write to Coalition for a Decent USA. I hope they're not a CIA front. I wouldn't know. I don't know who these people are. And sometimes these things that sound too good to be true are simply vacuums that take your name. But you might send them $1 or $5 or ask for literature. Coalition for a Decent USA, 420 Lexington Avenue, room 2060, New York, New York, 10017. There's one thing I know is that if the leaders aren't decent, then the people have to take their life into their own hands. So if you are not treated fairly, there's no way to impeach them unless you catch them in crimes again, such as Richard Nixon, and pull out some of the current crimes or the past crimes. But if they control the Justice Department and the CIA and the FBI tight enough, and you can't break through, then it's up to the people to get together. And I suggest writing to this organization and see what it's about, because certainly we need a coalition for a decent USA. It's terribly important. Now, the question of whether Reagan is a decent man or not, you can shoot a man who's not decent because you want someone who's worse, goes back to a program I did a while ago on Ronald Reagan's coming to power and how he came to power, and I promised to do more. There's a few missing pieces in the Ronald Reagan story and in the people around him. One of the men that helped his career, that discovered him, died last week, April the 29th, 1981. William Meikeljohn, Meikeljohn. Meikeljohn was a talent scout. He searched such people such as Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney, and he discovered Ronald Reagan. He died last week, as I say, and he went around the country. He began his career before he knew Reagan. In 1930, he joined the Music Corporation of America. Now, in 1919, Germany started rearming, and by 1920, the United States multinationals, Henry Ford and U.S. Steel and the Mellons and the DuPonts, were arming Hitler for the war against the Soviet Union. As soon as the revolution was over and Herbert Hoover came home from Europe after dispensing money to these armies to get ready for World War II, the Germans, in their mind, were going to get ready for World War II. And certainly by the 1930s, we were well into funding and thinking in terms of World War II to make war against Russia and arming what was the Nazi Party and Mussolini in Italy and Adolf Hitler in Germany. By 1936, Franco was given support during a brutal war by Mussolini and Hitler and took over Spain. Well, Michael John worked in Hollywood. He worked for Music Corporation of America. So to unlock certain pictures of Ronald Reagan, we have to go back and do more work into what Music Corporation was in 1930. We know at the time of Watergate, John Mitchell and Martha Mitchell and all the Republicans were at a party given by Music Corporation of America, and they've been very far, far right organization for many years. But how political they were in 1930s when Michael John worked for them, I don't know. He went into 1940, he started working for Paramount Picture. But it's interesting, among the people he discovered, one was Lucille Ball, who became a very conservative Republican through her career. And the other was Alan Ladd, who became a director of 20th Century Fox, which is a intertangling can of worms with the purchase of Fox Studio by Marvin Gaye from Denver, Colorado, that I go into in bits and pieces. But Alan Ladd was one of the people he discovered. And he got an introduction. Ronald Reagan was a radio announcer in Des Moines, Iowa, in 1937. That was right after in the period of the Spanish Civil War, actually, in the period where several years before Hitler was to invade Poland, 2 years before. And Ronald Reagan was in Des Moines, Iowa, and a woman named Joy Hodges contacted Bill Michael John to meet Ronald Reagan and give him a screen test. They compared him to another Robert Taylor, and he was flown out to Warner Brothers and got $200 a week contract at Warner Brothers that began the career of Ronald Reagan. It's an interesting career from the radio announcer to Hollywood, and after he was at Warner Brothers Studio in 1940, 1942, he made movies with Errol Flynn, who, according to Charles Higham, was deep into the Gestapo, working with German counterintelligence with many stars in Hollywood. And you have to read Errol Flynn, The Untold Story of Charles Higham, and the years of Flynn's work with the Gestapo and the Nazis, and make an overlay of the work that he did on two movies with Ronald Reagan. They were very much part of the social set together in Hollywood. So if we're working with a nice man, it's a good question. Can a president who's basically a decent man pursue policies that are not? But if we're working with a man who was on the fringe of the radical fascist and then working with the outright fascist from the Hoover Institute and in California through his entire career as he escalated into the political picture, then we're obviously working with somebody whose best interests are against the people of the United States. Our foreign policy, I think, has been misdirected, and the funds and intent gone the wrong way, as these columnists are now finding out and realizing. But the important thing is, how far ahead were people like Adolf Hitler or Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon selected for the role and groomed by corporations like General Electric or Music Corporation of America? Or they picked years before and put into strategic places as their careers escalated. In a few minutes, I'll go into bits and pieces of Alexander Haig's career. And a recent author about Haig said that he wasn't just a half-assed, haphazard kind of an escalation where he's in the right time and right place. He's been manipulative ever since he was at West Point and jumped over these people, hand-plucked right to Douglas MacArthur's side over in Asia at the time that important decisions and treaties were being signed. He went right out of his classmates group into the very important top people. He just made that giant leap, and he's stayed there ever since. Before I get to Haig again, and this does all tie into the Hinckley picture and foreign policy that I'm going into in Guatemala and other places, and the Vanderbilt Energy and the general kind of power, the manipulations behind the scene of people that are strategically placed and move up, such as Russell Little at the time of the SLA and the Nazis and the Republicans and William Colby, who formed the SLA, working with counterintelligence and Nazis, and then young people appearing as lone independents, just taking, in quotes, a political stand and having shootouts, whether they're in California or Washington. It's the same kind of organization that is between them, so they're not far apart. It's the end of the first half hour. We'll go on to John Hinckley and others in 1 minute. We'll take a 1 minute break. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California.